So before I get started, I just want to say that what brought me to dealing with this issue of resiliency slash stress and trauma was my work with the public employees unions around workplace violence prevention. And what I discovered is that people who work in state institutions, and I'm talking about every state in the country, you know, for mental health, juvenile offender facilities, et cetera, are physically assaulted. And they not only get physical injuries, but they're traumatized. And everybody reacts differently to trauma. That's in all of the training materials that we have. But we try to make people aware of that it's a normal reaction to a, you know, terrible event. And I was fortunate that we could take the work that I had done with, you know, the public employees who were being assaulted and traumatized and extend it to the disaster workers. I'm just curious, how many of you work directly with the disaster worker community? Raise your hand. So I'd say, yeah, maybe 60%. And how many of you work with other populations that maybe experience stress and trauma? Yeah. So the reason that I'm bringing this up is I feel that the training materials, although they're geared towards disaster workers, 90 to 95% of what's in them would be beneficial to anybody who is working in a traumatic, stressful environment, which I think that's our world. The 1%, the 0.1% are traumatizing us all so that they can make the money and, you know, we can work harder. My daughter is a school teacher, second year in Queens, New York. She works about 12 hours a day. She spends her own money on materials. And, you know, there's a lot of crying among the teachers. So I think that's just one example that that's close to home because I love my daughter. But supervisor course was the second of the series. And, you know, let me just say one other prefacing remark, which is that, you know, these were really geared towards rank and file workers and rank and file supervisors, so to speak. And so these are not an intervention. When I was working with the institutional population, we developed peer-based teams that were trained in psychological first aid, and we fought to get management commitment and 24/7 coverage by those teams. That's not what this is. This is an awareness training for workers and supervisors and clinicians. We need still to develop that intervention level training for the disaster community. Chip already did the background, so I'm not going to repeat it. But the overarching goal, as you can see, to prepare supervisors of disaster workers and volunteers to be proactive in recognizing and responding to stress and trauma. Also to be aware of their own reactions and provide leadership to increase individual and organizational resiliency. Here's the agenda of the course. We tried to use all the principles of adult learning, you know, very visual. All of the courses are very activity focused, small group activities, individual activities, and somewhat action oriented. Here were the overall objectives of the course: recognize signs and symptoms of disaster work related stress, understand the unique role of supervisors in balancing health, safety, resilience, and productivity, build your own team's resilience, obtain support through your organization and community resources, and provide leadership to the people you supervise. So the piloting was very instructive. These organizations are quite different in terms of who does the supervising. There was everything from around Hurricane Sandy, the volunteer organizations brought in people who were like case managers, so they weren't so much out there exposed to you know, the conditions on the ground, but they were dealing with people who were, to make the road, the folks that they brought were really community, they called them community health workers. And they weren't so much disaster workers, but they were disaster workers in the sense that the people in that community were experiencing day-to-day disasters, you know, no jobs, no income, illness, you know, problems with family. So, you know, definitely they embraced the program in that capacity. So some of the assumptions that are that supervisor exposed to the same types of stressors as other people. And typically, supervisors are not trained to address or recognize trauma and stress on themselves or the people they supervise. They have a responsibility for the well-being of their team. And that's not necessarily something that they're told up front or trained in. And the other thing is most people in a supervisory position have access to organizational resources that the worker or the volunteer might not have. This graphic, I think, is quite good. We really did this project the way you would want to, which is we piloted it, and we learned from the people in the pilots, and we kind of developed this with the input of the people from the bayous and the volunteer groups Make the Road, some of the unions we worked with. And the reason that the pendulum is more swinging to the left is that most supervisors are going to focus more on getting the work done. And when it comes to safety and workers' needs, you know, that's a little bit of a push with most organizations. There are exceptions. Some of the volunteer organizations around Sandy did have some safety and health programs, but they were pretty minimal. And they didn't really have a culture around occupational health and safety. For example, people were sent in to moldy homes and they hadn't had any medical screening or fit testing for respiratory protection. And so when Luis and I were on the ground doing training with some of these groups, we tried to scare the hell out of them that if you have some pre-existing medical condition, it could cause, you know, a real problem, and you really need to see your doctor before you, you know, work in a moldy environment. And some people, because of that, said, well, I ain't going in then. I'll do something else for the volunteer group. But that's the exception that NIHS trainers were available. That's just one example of kind of the stress and trauma people are under. The family and the personal stuff is huge. We heard from a safety supervisor from Dillard University, which was one of the pilots, about how when Katrina hit, he was pressured to help Dillard recover and do his work for Dillard's safety and health. At the same time, he was evacuating his family. And when they evacuated, he told this story about how the dog was on a rope and they had a thing of water, and that they were already down the road headed towards Texas where they were evacuating to, and they were like, oh, the dog. And the amazing thing is when they returned, I forget if it was 6 weeks later, the dog survived. I don't know how that happened, but these are just some of the stories that we heard about the traumas and stresses some of the supervisors experienced. So what are the impacts of stress on business and organizations? This is the kind of group discussion we had. If you want to shout something out, feel free. If I didn't hear you.
Displacement.
What else?
Not going to get the answers.
What's that? Income loss, sure. Anybody else? So we, you know, we get people thinking about these things. For supervisors, we're emphasizing the impact on the organization, but we also talked about the impact on the worker and their families. And this is the type of stuff, as I've been working in the labor movement my whole life, and we've always tried to get the employer to invest in health and safety and commit to health and safety, recognizing the negative impact on the organization. And of course, when I'm usually told, Jonathan, all we care about, the managers will say, is the pain and suffering of the workers, and then the union saying, oh, but think of all the money you're losing. It's kind of a role reversal, but I think it's kind of a healthy negotiation that you get into. And I think this is an important one. If people are traumatized, stressed, fatigued, there's the risk of unsafe working conditions, or the risk increases. We also talked about the stigma and the barriers to accessing and talking about mental health issues. And this is kind of a complex diagram, but you know, there's the issue of stigma. In the bayous, we were dealing with Vietnamese fishermen who became disaster workers, for example, and a culture where you really don't talk about your feelings, and you don't go to a psychologist. First of all, they don't have social workers and psychologists even available in the bayou. But beyond that, part of the design of this program is to overcome those barriers. Discrimination against people because they're stressed or traumatized, or they have a mental health problem. They're nuts. Fear, silence kind of leads to inaction. So the whole idea was to try to break through, and we did have some breakthroughs. There was some cops from the Thibodaux Police Department and Houma Police Department in the bayous, and the first part of the training they were like this. And I was sitting next to them, I said, what is this, the blue wall of silence? And the amazing thing is, when we went into the small group activity, Chip sat in the group, they described an event where there was a shooting, and the cop was told that he couldn't even talk to his wife for 6 months about what had happened.
Until his psychiatrist could come and talk to him.
Is that what it was? Okay. So, it was like we did get some breakthrough there. People started talking about these issues. So here's kind of what we laid out in terms of how ideally would you balance these demands as a supervisor. Make sure basic needs are met, communicate the problems, give the team an opportunity to speak. In other words, if you see somebody that's not working or is having a problem, don't immediately jump on them for not doing their job, but think about, well, I've been to this training and I now understand the reactions people have to stress and trauma, and maybe this person needs to talk or needs some help. Consider what else may be contributing to this. Be flexible and have a preparedness plan for your family and workplace. This was a big part of what we did. We tried to get the supervisors in the pilots and to kind of come up with what concretely could they do to support a stressed team member. And some of the things that people came up with, what I just said, understand that the changes might be a stress reaction and not somebody just not doing their job. Don't be quick to reprimand. Give team members an opportunity to talk, vent their frustrations. Bring in a trusted third party to help. And the point here is that in a lot of cases, the supervisor is the last person that the worker wants to talk to because they're the boss and they're worried that maybe the supervisor will have a negative thought of them if they admit that they're having a problem. So who could be the trusted third party? It could be a union representative. It could be a coworker. Could be a respected person in the workplace. Provide extra breaks. When we went to the NACHO conference last year, and presented the full training. One of the county groups, he described an incident where coworkers got into a fist fight, and this was like after 12-hour days, and he got them to kind of cool it, but he also gave them a day off because he realized that the fatigue and the stress were a big, big factor. This is a kind of a no-brainer, but in the American workplace, it's really rare for workers to have a voice on the job. Teaching supervisors to listen to the workers and give them input is always a positive thing. What can you do if you're the most stressed person in the room? Have any of you had supervisors that were the most stressed person in the room? So I actually stole that from my son. He's the one that brought that to my attention. So if that's the case, recognize your own reactions. Recognize that you're a role model to your team. Breathe and don't act hastily. I think that's I've seen a lot of supervisors, they get all excited and they do something that they maybe should regret. Take a break. Seek assistance. So I think that's pretty important in terms of the supervisor being aware. The training methods and content, I mentioned small group activities, individual worksheets. One of the things is the stress inventory, personal stress inventory, which is a rather old tool, but it was quite effective, and the pilots, it was well received. People basically list their personal stressors, everything from having a baby to a death in the family in the last 12 months, and there's a rating, and it kind of helps you quantify the personal stressors that you're bringing to the job, kind of an awareness thing. And the small group activities were really powerful. Some of the pilots did scenarios, and they did acting out, which was fun and also really educational. And we tried to tailor some scenarios to kind of fit in with different kinds of work that the different disaster groups were doing. And self-care was a big part of resilience. We're talking about healthy eating, healthy sleeping, exercise, socializing, and rest. Those are the five components. And we all are challenged with that, even if you're not, trying to increase your resilience working in a traumatic environment. But it becomes harder to do when you're working in a disaster scenario. And I think it's important for people to at least recognize the self-harming behaviors that people sometimes can engage in response to stress, and the positive things that you can do, like singing and playing music. And obviously referral becomes important. If the effects of the trauma and the stress are severe enough, then you definitely want to be able to let people know about effective resources. If it's on the job, it should be covered by workers' compensation, although I can tell you from my own advocacy experiences, the 52 states in the U.S., the employer and the insurance companies controvert 100% of psych cases. And you can establish a psych case if there's an event like a shooting or an assault, but if you can't show the event, it's much harder. They call it psych as opposed to physical psych. That's a whole nother issue. We already saw this workshop. These are the community health workers that we mentioned. There was a lot of hugging in this session. I loved it. The materials are in both Spanish and English. This is the numbers that we had, and the evaluations were really, we had a professional evaluator, and the evaluations were really positive from the participants and the trainers. And I think part of it was we were able to keep tweaking and tailoring the materials, which is, to me, a kind of a luxury. It's the way you're supposed to do these programs, but usually people don't have the resources or the organizational support to do that. So here's kind of future needs. We need to disseminate this program, all three of them, and test them and improve them. And we need to get people to tailor the materials to the populations that you're working with. I think that can be done easily. We need to research the long-term impact of these programs. One good thing that's happening is Stony Brook University is one of the World Trade Center medical monitoring programs. And they have psychologist Adam Gonzalez, and he got an ASPR grant to evaluate the worker training program among World Trade Center responders who live in Long Island and also were affected by Sandy. And we saw some preliminary results, and they were really positive. So we're excited about that. But we need a lot more evaluation to go on. Another thing that people often don't have the time or resources for. And, you know, the point that I made earlier is that this isn't a substitute for developing organizational systems, you know, such as, let me just say one quick thing on that, which is my experience is initially there was CISM, the Critical Incident Stress Management programs developed by Jeff Mitchell after the Oklahoma City bombing. And it turned out that was never peer reviewed. They were doing like these big group psychological debriefings. And when it was peer reviewed, it was discovered that because everybody reacts differently to stress and trauma, that doing these big group psychological debriefings could do as much harm as good. The timing for each individual is different. So the model that we were developing when I was working for the union in New York were peer-based teams that provided individual service, voluntary, only if the worker wanted the service. And it was a peer so that it was somebody who walked the walk and talked the talk. And it was a peer who was trained in psychological first aid, a method developed by, I think, the VHA. And it's not counseling, it's peer support. But, there's psychoeducation component to it, an organizational support component to it. And where we implemented it in the state of New York, it had a really great impact on the injured workers. And I knew this anecdotally because I was advocating for these injured workers around workers' comp issues. And, I could just see a very different response to people who had organizational support versus those who had none. That's the end.
I'm going to bring up Betsy in just a second, but I think that was a perfect segue to talk about the issues that both Jonathan and Chip raised about understanding the risk factors, for mental health, understanding the risk factors for physical health, not only in the short term, which our system set up for that acute surveillance, how many injured, how many sick, how many show up in the hospital, but really understanding what are the risk factors for resiliency, both personal and community, and understanding some of these longitudinal health effects. We talked a little bit about some of the situations and disasters. The World Trade Center was actually one of the few situations that we got some information, and really about the response workers for the most part, and it showed profound effects, both in terms of longitudinal respiratory effects in that population, and also in terms of post-traumatic stress disorders and depression in the area of 30-40% of the individuals that were involved. So it shows how important it is to not only be able to look at these issues and capture it, but and do it in other situations. We worked on the Gulf oil spill, as Chip talked about, and this issue about who are the workers is really important, because it's a, you know, in a disaster, the workers is a really diverse group of individuals that are involved in the situation, and including some of the people who are not only responders, but also their homes and families are simultaneously affected while they're trying to do work. In the Gulf oil spill, there was 150,000 individuals involved in cleanup activities from a range of volunteers, people walking the beach, cleaning animals, doing all sorts of work, and similarly in Superstorm Sandy. So we began, and this is going to be kind of a segue to introduce Betsy here, began working on some of these things because in the Gulf oil spill, we tried to do a longitudinal study of the workers that were involved in that cleanup. There were 150,000, so we said, okay, we're going to try. The National Academy of Sciences said, hey, we need to study this because there's been a lot of oil spills and there's no data about the health effects, period. There's just no data on the community. There's no data on the workers. There's a couple of quick cross-sectional studies, and we don't really understand, so why don't you try to do this? So it took 8 months to field a longitudinal cohort, epidemiologic cohort study, to begin to look at this. And you lose all sorts of information by starting 8 months later. So partly as a lesson to us and not only to CDC and others that were involved in trying to look at some of these issues for a long time, we start too slow. We're never in a place. These disasters, these situations happen, and we lose information all the time. We say, oh, we should have got that. We should have looked at this. We should have looked at the efficacy of what we do and get some formative data to understand if what we're trying to do in these responses and these disasters is actually working on a number of fronts. And we don't capture that. You know, the Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy hit the East Coast, and the mold issue was again front and center. Lots of different people encountering, going into homes, cleaning up their residences, or coming in volunteers. And we have, again, this has been going on for 20 years when I started doing disasters in the early 90s, these mold issues, and yet we still had no survey tools. We had no formative database to say, oh, what should we really tell people other than saying, avoid it? Well, that's not really the necessary, you know, option. We need to give them real information about who's at risk and about the real things they could do to protect themselves and their families, and that wasn't in place. So we started a program at NIEHS with the National Library of Medicine called the Disaster Research Response Program, or DR2, and trying to see if we can't speed up our processes. One was, what are the important questions that we should have ready to go? But also when Ebola hit, and Chip talked about it this morning, well, really a huge question was, is it transmitted to people, you know, from on the bus or somebody in a room or hours later in the air? What do we really have to understand those risks? And if we don't have something to understand those risks, we better be able to turn to people in the public and say, we don't know this, here's what we understand about it, but here's what we're going to do about what we don't know. And so we started to work on this project to speed up and figure out ways to work together with our various federal, state, local, and health partners to get that kind of information. So we began to, one, outline a way to try to identify some of the research questions. We had some models for that. Chip mentioned this morning about the National Academy of Sciences and the Ebola workshop, which then basically said, hey, we don't know about all these issues about Ebola, by the way. You know, they've run in experts from around the world. And said, and by the way, worker protection is really important here, and that we need to understand some of these risk factors to be able to understand what are the risks to workers, and not just doctors and nurses, but a broad range of workers, which is translated into these programs that we've been working on. Similarly, some of the low-hanging fruit to me and to our program was, how do we just have these, you know, tools, surveys, things available? And we develop them all the time. So in the mold stuff, we were developing them back in the 90s, but yet when something happened, they weren't readily available. So we started working with the National Library of Medicine, and we created a repository of 165 tools and differing things to make that available. And we have sheets in the back that explain a little bit of this. As part of that, also, we developed a protocol, first one from NIH, that was pre-approved by our IRB, for the research community to start using a protocol, or at least for our research community, to get out in the field and do something faster. 9 months is insufficient. Can we make it faster, smarter, and then be able to understand what's happening to people over time? And as part of this, we've started to communicate, because we don't see research as a domain of the federal government, but it's really the domain of all of us. Everybody in here and our community partnerships is really the ones who need to help us figure out what to do. And a good example for the oil spill was not just the workers, but the communities partnering with academic centers actually defined what was of importance to them, those research questions that were critical to their community, and began funded research looking at those across the Gulf. And so we've been doing some exercises to test these concepts and to think about how do we work with communities in ways to collect timely information that we care about in ways that are helpful to decision makers and helpful to us to understand these situations. So Betsy's going to talk about two exercises that we did as part of this program.